All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good evening, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, a CW-2 type helicopter pilot, Vietnam 1969. Welcome to Veterans Radio. We're very excited to have you here this evening. We're going to be talking about Pearl Harbor. The 75th anniversary of Pearl Harbor is coming up in the middle of next week, and we've got a documentary filmmaker has made a very interesting documentary utilizing lost audio tapes from the 1940s. That I think you'll find fascinating. He's going to be on later on. His name is Tom Jennings. And we're going to talk about some other things as we go along. And we want you to give us a call here on Veterans Radio if you'd like to get in on the conversation. The local number is 734-822-1600. 734-822-1600. If you have an event coming up in the next couple of weeks, because you know it's the Christmas season and there's a lot of veterans activities going on, let us know. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, and let us know about your event that is coming up. We'd love to help promote that if we can. We're going to be promoting a couple of events today just to let you know what's going on around here on Veterans Radio. You can follow us, as I said, on our website. That's veteransradios.net. You can also follow us on Facebook. Yes, we know how to do some posting, or if we don't know how to do it, we have somebody that'll do it for us. We also have a Twitter account, and evidently we've got some podcasts that are up, and of course, many of our 13-year worth of programs are up on our website in our archives, so you can always follow Veterans Radio. We'd like to consider ourselves the voice of America's veterans, and we definitely want to tell the story. So again, another thing is if you have a story that you think that we would like to tell here on Veterans Radio, please don't hesitate to contact us. For those of you that have been sending us musical clips, I'm going to try and put those together and put them all up on our website before the end of the year. These are songs that are written for veterans, by veterans, about veterans. And so we're really excited to gather a whole collection of those. As you might remember, we did a program on Michael J. Martin and Tim Holliday's music a couple of weekends ago. So if I learn how to talk again. And that turned out to be really popular. A lot of people responded that they love the music and they'd like to see us do more musical programs with veterans music. So let us know if you've got a song that you think that we would like to spread out to the world on our Veterans Radio program. Right now I have an event that's coming up in New York, and I think this is kind of cool for those of you on the East Coast. It's a holiday vet together and benefit concert, and it's coming up tomorrow night, December 5th, and it's sponsored by the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America and Marcus Goldhaber, and it's to celebrate our veterans during Pearl Harbor, the 75th anniversary week, and to help fund a new album called Carry You On, and it sounds pretty fascinating. It's going to be held at the Prohibition Club, 503 Columbus Avenue at 84th Street. In New York, Monday, tomorrow night. No cover charge for veterans and active duty military. And if you want to find out more about it, you can go to Kickstarter video, Carry You On, The Voice for Veterans. And again, that's tomorrow night, Holiday Vet Together and Benefit Concert at the Prohibition Club at 503 Columbus Avenue at 84th Street in New York City. No cover charge for veterans and active duty military. There's going to be lots of music, lots of entertainment, and I think if you get an opportunity to go to that, it should be terrific. It starts at 6 o'clock Eastern Time, runs till 8 o'clock. There's a concert and raffles, all kinds of things. So go ahead. Holiday Vet Together to celebrate the Pearl Harbor 75th Anniversary Week. Introduce some great music and sponsored by the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America. And 50% of all the proceeds go to the Iraq-Afghanistan Veterans of America. So if you're happy to be wandering around the streets of New York tomorrow night, head on over. I think you'll have a good time. We also wanted to talk about the Wreaths over Across America, and I don't know if we've reached her yet or not. Any word on that? Nope. All right. Well, I'll just talk about it a little bit, and hopefully she will join us in just a second. We're expecting a call from the executive director of Wreaths Across America. For those of you that aren't familiar with it, this is an organization that is what they attempt to do is during the Christmas season, they attempt to put a wreath on especially all of the grave sites in Arlington Cemetery in Washington, D.C., but they're also attempting to do this at many, many national cemeteries across the country. And there are many organizations, a lot of different states that are doing this, and they're trying to collect it. You know, obviously, this is a volunteer organization, and they're hoping that people can help out. There's a number of cemeteries here in the local Ann Arbor area in Washtenaw County. I know there's a couple up in Pinckney. There's one over in Canton and in Plymouth. And so we're hoping that we'll get to talk to her in just a little bit. Meanwhile, and you can find out more about this by going to their website. That's wreathsacrossamerica.org. That's wreaths, W-R-E-A-T-H, crossamerica.org. And it's just a great organization. And they've, you know, this started out with somebody just coming up with the idea of, you know, hey, this is something that we can do for our veterans. And so they put some wreaths out there, and now it's kind of exploded into this across the country organization that is trying to put these Christmas wreaths on pretty much every veteran's gravestone that's out there. And I think it's great. And I'm hoping that we can talk with Karen a little bit later. Right now, I'm going to take a real quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a new organization here in Michigan. And I think that you're going to like that one, too. And that's the Michigan Military Heritage Museum out in the big giant suburbs of Grass Lake, Michigan. So stay tuned for that. And we'll be right back after this short message. And that is Remember Pearl Harbor. And there are probably many of you out there that still can remember that. I, unfortunately, cannot. There are many of us that cannot remember what was going on December 7th of 1941. And we'll find out more about that as we get together later on with our guest on the Lost Tapes from Pearl Harbor that talks about the recorded history of Pearl Harbor. Many of these tapes are things that we have never heard before, and so I think it's kind of interesting. And but joining me on the line right now from the Michigan Military Heritage Museum, I had the opportunity to go out there last week. This is out in Grass Lake, Michigan, which is about 20, 25 miles west of Ann Arbor. Off on I-94, you get off at exit 150, you go south past the Dunkin' Donuts, and it's almost into the town of Grass Lake there on the left-hand side, and it's a great little museum, and I want to welcome, I think he's the founder of the whole thing, and that's Scott Gerich. And Scott, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hi, Dale. Thank you.
So tell me, where did this idea come for a military museum in Grass Lake, Michigan?
Well, it came from two places. The first one was just a group of guys that had been involved in collecting and reenacting and doing things like that for their entire lives. And as people get older, they tend to try to figure out what to do with those things. So the idea came to put something somewhere, and there were some talks with Fort Wayne and Detroit and a few other places, and none of it really panned out. And then just through a school project with some kids, the Grass Lake Historical Society was looking to partner with a group to do an expansion on some Michigan history. It's, Michigan history is required, local history is required in a school curriculum now, and they wanted to do something. So it became a partnership with the original guys and with the Historical Society being the 501c3 nonprofit. And we settled in Grass Lake a couple of years ago collecting stories. We decided that the objects were great, but we really needed the stories to go with them. And then this year, kind of out of left field, we had an opportunity to get a new building. So the building that you saw was a brand new building. And then from the time you were there till today, it has changed. more exhibits were added, and we'll continue to work on that.
Well, it sounds like you've got a great crew of people out there that are interested in helping out too.
Yeah, that's great. It's all volunteers. Nobody gets paid. Again, like I said, a lot of guys that were reenactors, collectors, the folks from the Historic Society that have an interest in this and seem to have found that they had more of an interest in this than they originally thought. So a lot of gals that come out and work really hard on the exhibits and getting the stories from veterans and veteran families. And that's really what we want to do, is share that Michigan history. And I heard you mention later on this USS Arizona, and there was a single Michigan survivor from the Arizona. So, you know, it ties in. I think it's, they're stories that should be told.
Well, I certainly agree, Scott, and we're talking with Art Garrett, who's kind of the founder, I'm going to say, of the Michigan Military Heritage Museum, and it's part of the Grass Lake Area Historical Connections, evidently, and I met the director of that, Marilyn, yesterday, and it's a great little, right now I'd say it's a great little museum, and you've got uniforms from every era of American military, and you mentioned that you right now, let's talk about the exhibits that you've got right now of the uniforms from World War One.
Yeah, so that's one of the partnerships is with Michigan's World War One Centennial Program, and it's a fellow from Ann Arbor who started it named Dennis Skupinski, and Dennis has been seeking recognition for the 100th anniversary coming up for the U.S. entry into World War One. So what we have now, and we've done some checking, is not the largest, but the most comprehensive exhibit of its type in the country on uniforms of the Western Front, and then coupled with a separate exhibit on the Michigan stories. So it represents most of the countries that were involved in World War One, and it's just a really fantastic exhibit. If people are interested in World War One, I'd say it's a must-see thing. You won't see anything like it anywhere else in Michigan, and probably unless you go to Kansas City.
Well, I just found it really fascinating. Not only that exhibit, but you've got stories to go along with so many of your exhibits there, and I thought that's what was so fascinating. All these people were not necessarily from Grass Lake, which is not a very large community at all. But you've got people there who did serve during World War One, World War Two, Vietnam, and so forth, and you've got some really interesting stories out there.
Well, certainly, it's a Michigan-themed museum, so it's not centric to Grass Lake. I mean, I guess it was a lot easier to get the word out locally and have some of those Grass Lake stories, but we've got stories from Otnagan, up in the Upper Peninsula and many other areas in the state. So they do reach out pretty far, and some of them are really, really great stories. The sailor who went down with the USS Indianapolis and the pilot who discovered the survivors of the Indianapolis side by side, the sailor from Detroit and the pilot being from Jackson. And then just a wide range, as you said, stories from the War of 1812. There's a settler that settled here in, just north of Grass Lake, who was a captain in a militia unit in the War of 1812. So there's a story that goes with him and some original items that the family had saved, a British cannon from the Detroit River. We were the recipients of one of those from the Detroit Historic Society, and had some local volunteers get together and built a carriage for it and restored it, and it's on exhibit. So it's one of the oldest pieces of Michigan military history that you would ever see.
I would think so. Scott, how did you get involved with the Michigan Military Heritage Museum? What is your background? How did you do this?
Well, I was in the Army for 23 years.
Okay.
And they came to me one day and said, "You can't be in the Army anymore. Your VA rating is too high."
Oh, okay.
So I had to get out of the Army, and they said, you can go to school. The VA will let you go to school under the vocational rehab program. So I did that for a while and got a bachelor's degree, and they said, the VA came back and said, okay, you have to go and find a job, and, you know, here's some prospects. And all the jobs were less than what the VA was paying me to do nothing. And so the VA came back and said, well, you need to go and get a higher degree so you can get a job that will be a better paying job.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, I don't know that I could get a better paying job doing history. They don't pay that well. And so we had come to an agreement that I could continue on in school and do something working with a museum. So while I was in school, I worked at the Yankee Air Museum over at Willow Run.
Mm-hmm.
And then left there. And I guess just as a continuation and in keeping the deal with the folks at the VA, got to work on this project. So as you had mentioned, Marilyn is the president, not me.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think I'm just a volunteer, but I guess I'm the guy with the history degree and the military background.
Well, you certainly are. And Scott and I had really interesting discussions yesterday. You are an expert in military history. I'd have to say that. And I'm not trying to, you know, toot any horns here. I just was fascinated by what you knew about all of the stories that were in the museum, and it's, you know, especially since it's just beginning. Is there any particular one story that we could share with our audience?
Wow.
I know that's putting you on.
Yeah, there's a great one. His name was Fred Nock, and Fred was a 19-year-old PFC in the infantry in World War II. He was at the 84th Division at the Battle of the Bulge, and I guess I should start backwards and say that I, through Fred's brother, I think I kind of get to know Fred.
Mm-hmm.
Fred passed away several years ago, but Fred's brother had approached us, learned about this museum project, and Fred was one of these guys that could sketch things as he saw them. And so at 19 years old, he sketched everything that he saw while he was in the service, whether it be the swearing-in ceremony, life in the barracks, people on the streets, or the, you know, the images of combat. And all these sketches were saved. At the same time, Fred wrote a letter home to his mother every day that he was in service. There's literally four bins of letters.
Wow.
That the family saved. In the unit history that describes their actions in the Battle of the Bulge, there was a excerpt that read that a German captain had drawn a bead on Fred and was getting ready to kill him. They were very close, and two of the guys in the unit ended up capturing the captain. And in and among the artifacts and souvenirs that Fred sent home was the captain's uniform. So we have Fred's uniform. We have all the other items that he saved, all the drawings, all the letters that he sent to his family, all what they used to call the V-mails,
mm-hmm.
And the German captain. And
wow.
It's just a fantastic story. And they led a very structured life. Fred was never married. His brother was never married. As I'm told, they lived next door to each other for 70 years over in the Chelsea area. And there was a third house, and they would meet there for dinner. So
that's part of the thing that is so cool about, well, I think, what you're doing out there. Scott, yesterday you were telling me, I'm not that much of a historian when it comes to the state of Michigan. I'm not from Michigan originally, but there was a POW camp right out near there.
Yeah, and just north of Grass Lake on the north side of I-94 at exit 150, our same exit, was Camp Waterloo. And Michigan had these small camps all over the state, and most of the prisoners would come out in the spring from Camp Custer or from down in Detroit near Fort Wayne. And they would work in the farm fields, and they received payment for doing that. I think they received about 60 cents a day. And they helped the farmers because all the young men were off to war. And the difference with Camp Waterloo as opposed to many of the others was that it had been a brand new CCC camp just prior to the war, so it had facilities that could sustain the prisoners year-round. So it became a year-round facility. It housed, through its time, 43 to 46, a little over 1,000 German prisoners. So they just, the Department of Corrections took it over, Michigan Department of Corrections mm-hmm. took it over after the war, and they just finished tearing it out about a year and a half ago, what was left of it up in the Waterloo Recreation Area. So that kind of gave the idea of putting a museum in Grass Lake that was a military theme, the historical backdrop that a lot of museums look for.
Well, I would think so. From my understanding, many of those German prisoners would have liked to have stayed here instead of gone back when they'd be repatriated, I think.
There's some that they all had to be repatriated. That was the law.
Mm-hmm.
But there were some that came back, and there's some books out there. I can't off the top of my head give you a title, but I believe one is a man in Michigan, and some came back. They loved it here. They were in awe of the land that was available and the freedoms that they had.
And yeah, I think it was very similar. And there were a lot of Germans here too.
Definitely, in this area, there's a lot of there's a big German Lutheran church in the Waterloo area, and people were able to communicate with the prisoners to get them to do the farm work, and I suppose keep them pacified, if that's the right word, to minimize escape attempts. Although there were attempts. There's another good story of at Camp Waterloo, where a German soldier stole a Jeep and tried to escape and was out for 48 hours traveling through Waterloo, and they got him about three-quarters of a mile away.
Sounds like
he didn't know where he was or where he was going, and of course, I-94 wasn't there at the time. So.
No, I was going to say, nor was GPS, so
right.
You know, where exactly am I? I'm looking at your website here on the computer, and it's lifeinmichigan.com/Michigan Military Heritage Museum.
Oh, no, that's actually a
correct.
Great website. That's a group that did a story on us.
Okay.
But the website is the overall website for the Historical Society, www.glahc.com.
Okay.
And that has information on all of the projects that we're working on.
Okay.
And then we have a Facebook page, which is the Grass Lake Area Historical Society. And again, all of those, the Life in Michigan, glahc.com, and the Facebook page, particularly the Facebook page, has a lot of photos of the museum and a co-house museum, which is our other museum, the local history museum.
I would really encourage people to go. I haven't been to your glahc.com website yet, but the Life in Michigan one has a picture of this World War I German drum captured by 4th Platoon, 72nd Battalion Canadians, donated by Major, there's a rip in the cover, McClellan from Vancouver, Canada. Where did that come from?
So that's part of the large World War I exhibit, the Western Front exhibit. And I think for me, the amazing thing is that all of that exhibit was one man's collection.
Hmm.
And there are... In the scope of mannequins, there are a little more than 30 full mannequins of uniforms, and it's one-third of the collection that he has, and he lives in a condominium. So
right.
it's quite a collection, and it's going to be on display through 2018, through the 100th anniversary. We're working right now on an event for April that will... kick off this 100th anniversary of the U.S. entry that will tie in somewhere along the lines of recipes for hors d'oeuvres and cocktails that were served at the time.
Oh.
and it'll be a fundraiser.
Well, let us know more about that. We'd love to help you promote that. If anybody wanted to make a donation of either uniforms or a story, how would they get in touch with you, Scott?
So the best way, two ways. One would be by phone, and that would be at 517-522-2000. 2042, and that would put them in direct contact with me. And we can also be reached at info@glahc.com, and that's monitored by our president, okay. Marilyn O'Leary. And so that would be the email that would coincide with the website, the glahc.com website. And that website's set up for PayPal donations and.
Okay. Well, I would strongly suggest people go to that website, glahc.com, and find out more information about the Michigan Military Heritage Museum. It's a great little museum. Hopefully it'll become a great big museum, and we would love to help you out along the way. And if anybody has any stories or any paraphernalia, all the stuff, if you're trying to clean out the closet of your dad's military things, get a hold of these folks. They could use that. Scott, thank you very much for being on Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Dale. Thank you for coming out.
Oh, it was my pleasure. I look forward to seeing you again.
Me too.
All right. We're going to be taking a break here for the news, and when we come back, we're going to be listening to a segment of the Lost Tapes, Pearl Harbor. These are tapes that most of us have never heard before. So get ready for that, and we'll be back right after this message and the news.
Take you to Honolulu.
1, 2, 3, 4. Hello, NBC. Hello, NBC. This is KTU in Honolulu, Hawaii. I am speaking from the roof of the Advertiser Publishing Company building. We have witnessed this morning the distance view. Battle of Pearl Harbor and the severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done. This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours. And no joke. It is a real war. We cannot estimate yet how much damage has been done, but it has been a very severe attack. The Navy and Army appear now to have the
One moment, please.
That was a segment that was taken from the Lost Tapes Pearl Harbor that was on, it's on the internet at the Lost Tapes Pearl Harbor. It's a Smithsonian Channel special that is going to be played tonight at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. And for those of you out there that you want to listen to it here in the local area, these channels, I'll try to give them out. I'll give them out again later on too, but it's at 9 p.m. tonight on Comcast. It's channel 388. On DirecTV, it's channel 570. On your dish, it's 367. And on AT&T, it's 118. Joining me on the line right now is the producer of The Lost Tapes, and that is Tom Jennings. And Tom is a Peabody Award-winning documentary producer with more than 400 hours of programming to his credit, and we know that that's a lot of work. Just doing our program. Started his career as a journalist writing for newspapers. And after covering the O.J. Simpson criminal trials, he began making nonfiction films as a writer on the Discovery Network. And writing led to producing, which led to directing, and so on and so forth. And I just want to welcome Tom Jennings to Veterans Radio. Welcome, Tom.
Hi, Dale. Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate being here.
So tell me about these tapes. I was fascinated when I was able to watch this program in advance. I was very fortunate enough to get the code to get into to get in to watch it. And tell me where this idea came from.
Well, this idea came from actually my childhood. I was always fascinated by events like Pearl Harbor. And you may remember, some of your listeners may remember an old CBS show called You Are There.
Absolutely.
Which was kind of made for kids, but it really appealed to all ages. And the idea was that Walter Cronkite would sit in a news anchor's chair and then send report, you know, he would talk to his reporters in the field, but they would be covering stories that did not have electronic media at the time. I think I remember one where he talked to Dan Rather on the deck of the sinking Titanic, for example. And that always fascinated me that, you know, to be able to experience something in real time like that. And, of course, today we're so used to the 24-hour news cycle that we can just experience everything almost instantaneously. But events like Pearl Harbor, and we've done other things about the assassination of Martin Luther King, for example, or John F. Kennedy, it was very difficult to get that feel of being in the moment. So in a sense, what we're doing is, I like to call it a reverse You Are There. Instead of having their correspondents out in the field talking with actors who are portraying the people that actually lived through these events, we use the actual footage and everything else we can get our hands on to try and create a seamless telling of what it was like to be a part of these events or witnessing these events or just being alive at the time and realizing what was happening. And in our search for lots of material, we came across this report that you just played from KGU. Mm-hmm. It's the only known live recording that was made during the attack, and bits and pieces of it may be familiar to some of your listeners from before, but one of the things that makes our shows work so well is you don't get 10 seconds of it. You get to hear the whole thing.
I mean, that's why I wanted to play as much of that as I could. Even when I was downloading it, you can hear a little jumping on it. But but the idea of this poor guy is doing this report. I mean, he's an observing. You can hear all the bullets flying all over the place, and then he gets interrupted by the operator.
Yes. He's actually doing that report from, I think we put a little text up on the screen. He's on the roof of the Honolulu Advertiser newspaper building, I think it was. Yeah. And something fascinating about that is, you know, when we make these kind of programs, we only use material that's authentic, the real material. It might not be from the exact moment, but if we're showing Hawaii at the time, it was taken, those images or pictures were taken at the time. And we always try and identify everyone, in this case, the radio reporter. And to this day, it's a mystery of who that guy was.
Oh.
No one knows his name. And he made this phone call. They know he was a reporter at the time, but for some reason, KGU, people in Hawaii, no one knows who he is or was. And the part two of this mystery is, we were told in trying to find out who he was, we were told that his phone call was cut short actually by someone in the military. The operator came on to stop him, but actually he was told during his broadcast that he was going to have to stop because they were afraid that the Japanese pilots were listening in on broadcasts from Honolulu and could get information about the damage they were inflicting by this guy telling them, basically from being on the ground and witnessing it. They would hear, you know, we need to go this way because we haven't done enough damage over there. So that's kind of the folklore behind it. The missing name of the reporter, and also the, did he really get cut off by the government because they were afraid that he would be giving away what was happening on the ground to the enemy?
Wouldn't surprise me. I mean, It seems to me, I remember that the Japanese pilots did home in on radio stations in Hawaii, because that's what we used to do when I was a pilot in Vietnam. We would home in on the radio station in Saigon, so we always knew where we were in relationship to Saigon. And it's just fascinating. Were these tapes, were they tapes, or were these the metal recordings that you got, or were they a vinyl?
How did these are tapes. Most of, and since you watched the program, you know that there's a lot of reporting as kind of America slowly finds out what happened that day. You hear a lot of NBC, CBS reporting interrupting the LA New York Philharmonic.
Yeah, right.
The broadcast of that, which was a regular feature on Sunday afternoons, and those. Normally, when we do archive-based shows, we go to NBC, for example, or CBS, and we'll say, what do you have from this particular event? But these events go back so far, and this day is such a part of American history, that two things happen. One is NBC doesn't have their recordings from back then. They're all in the National Archives on tape reels, old reel-to-reel reels. Now, I don't know if that was the original source, but they've been that way for a long, long time. And again, because we use so much of what happened and not just the highlights reel, that we had to spend 10 full hours just digitizing old reel-to-reel tape recordings of the news reports that happened just on December 7th, that day. So the source material from which that came, and from probably 90% of what you hear in the show, came from reel-to-reel tapes that are housed in the National Archives, and the Archives now has us to thank because we digitized them for them.
I can relate.
So there's digital copies now.
I can relate to that. I had to do that with some music that we played a couple of weeks ago that was only on cassette.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we're talking with Tom Jennings, producer of the Lost Tapes Pearl Harbor, which is going to be seen tonight on the Smithsonian Channel at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. And I'll go through those channels later on during this. One of the things that I found really fascinating, Tom, was that there is no narration to this program. It's just the tapes and photographs in the background. You put a couple of, word slides up on there, but it's just one recording after another, which is just fascinating.
Well, that's, in order to refer back to years ago, You Are There, those shows played as if they were happening in real time, even though they were about events that obviously had happened long ago. And in order for us to create the feeling of being alive or being in Honolulu at the time of the attack and experiencing it, a narrator or doing interviews with people who are experts or even survivors who are still alive today, it kind of takes you out of the moment. I mean, it's a different way of telling the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we want to do, no one knows what it's like to have to be a veteran and have lived through something like that, or lived through what you've been through, or lived through what many of your audience has been through. But what we try and do is take the material that was available at that time and give people a little bit more of a glimpse, if that's possible, to understand what it was like to experience that. Instead of, I think it's a different kind of storytelling animal when you have professors explaining, why Japan attacked and giving you all the theories behind that, versus just letting the information play. And so that's very, to notice what you did is, yes, there is no narration, there's no interviews, and that's done on purpose, but that makes our job that much more difficult.
Because
a narrator makes everything go away if you have a problem telling, to making a turn in a story point. Mm-hmm. We don't have that luxury.
Well, I like it because I think, as you implied, is that we were able to make our own decisions. We don't have somebody telling us what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked that. And I'm sorry I don't have more clips to play for you and for our audience. I encourage everybody to watch this program tonight at 9 o'clock on the Smithsonian Channel, is that the first person really almost to address the nation was Eleanor Roosevelt, not Franklin.
Isn't that fascinating? I had no idea. In exploring this program specifically, and I like to think that I'm a student of history and I, try and understand as much as what went on, but there's one thing about understanding the situation or knowing, about the Arizona and the Oklahoma and things like that. It's another thing to be imagining yourself sitting in, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio originally, and I know you're in Michigan, to be, in the Midwest on that day, hearing these bits and pieces of things coming out. Maybe an extra edition is being, printed by the newspapers in the Midwest time that something's going on in Hawaii, but the first person to address the nation was, everyone thinks it was Franklin Roosevelt, the president, the following day, which was December 8th when he spoke to Congress so eloquently, but Eleanor Roosevelt, the first lady, had a weekly radio broadcast that it was kind of like her version of a fireside chat, like her husband would have on occasion. She did a weekly broadcast, and a lot of it was about talking with the troops or talking with veterans and explaining, what it's like to be far from home. She'd often talk to the women in the country at the time about issues that they were dealing with. And by chance, her program aired on Sunday nights. And so the attack happened Sunday morning, and normally a lot of her program, and this isn't explained in the show, it didn't really need to be, but a lot of her program was pre-recorded, being, the First Lady of the United States. She would have to, do segments here and there, and the engineers would put them together, as you're familiar with, but this just happened, so she had to go into a studio with only a couple of hours heads up and talk to the nation, speaking on behalf of herself as the First Lady and really the first representative of the government to make a long, in-depth public statement about what had just happened. And it's fascinating. I had no idea that Eleanor Roosevelt had a weekly radio broadcast in 1941.
I'm just sitting here thinking of the social media of her time.
Yes, it was very much so.
And I don't know how old you are, but I'm old enough. I'm old enough to remember the radio, and that was what everybody would listen to all day. It just was kind of background noise. And but you listen to all of these programs, and this was the only way we would find out what was going on.
Exactly.
According to what my parents said, that, on December 7th is that, the whole world was tied to their radio, and especially, of course, the next day when Franklin Roosevelt gave his address. And you have a great segment in there, of course, of that address, but it's not the 22nd one that we hear all the time.
Correct.
He said a lot more in that, and plus you have samples of his the script, and I love how you have that as – kind of scratched out from, we'll live in infamy, that sounds better.
And, at one point he had world history. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another thing we try and do that, I hope when people tune in tonight, they'll be able to experience this in a different way. I've done shows about Pearl Harbor in the past that are very traditional, where you get experts and survivors and, you use small clips of footage. And, there's been 100 documentaries for television made, if not more. And everyone uses the first, it's basically about the first 10 seconds of Roosevelt's Declaration of War speech on December 8th, which is a day that will live in infamy. So two things about that. One is, you noted his, we were able to obtain, his handwritten draft where he was experimenting with the words the night before on how to say it. And I think at one point he said, a day that will live in world history. you know, and then he crossed out world, and then it was history, and, you know, he goes down the line, and then he finally gets to infamy. So you can see how his brain is working on the page, which is fascinating. The other thing is that most people don't think about, they think of a presidential speech, for example, the way we are used to them today, the State of the Union or something like that, lasting for 30 or 40 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
This, his speech that day was less than 5 minutes long, and we play the whole thing. And we show images that support what he's saying at that time. Mm-hmm. And he lays out the whole thing. And one of the most fascinating statements that he makes is the distance between Japan and Hawaii proves that the Japanese were planning this for a long, long time, because mm-hmm. just to move all of those ships and planes into a position to attack took weeks of planning, if not, you know, moving men and machinery around.
Moving aircraft carriers 3,000 miles.
And you never hear that part of the speech. And it's when you hear it in its context, instead of just the sound bite, as we call them today, it becomes much more, there's a deeper sense of what he was trying to say than just a day that will live in infamy. There was so much more to it. And so I'm glad you mentioned that. And your viewers will, your audience will, if they view this tonight, they'll be able to see the speech in its entirety.
I just find it fascinating that you were able to find all these pieces.
Yeah.
And able to put them together in a logical fashion. And we can, you know, we see the idea of the lead up to the war and, you know, the warnings and everybody
right.
saying, you know, don't do this, don't do that. And I think actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but during the program, you can see the Japanese are meeting with the Americans on the
mm-hmm.
day of, you know,
correct.
Well, this is not going to work. And they'll kind of, you know, break off their conversation. And, you know, the next day, and you're able to look at the pictures of Franklin Roosevelt delivering this speech.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the anguish in his facial features already.
Yeah.
And this is, you know, and we know that it obviously took a toll on him, but it also took a toll on the country. And the lead up to this, and you mentioned these things, and I don't want to spoil it for everybody, but I will a little bit, is, you know, not everybody wanted to go to war.
That's correct. There was a big isolationist movement at the time. That you're correct, including a very famous aviator at the time who is in the program, who gives a speech about why the United States should stay out. And we address it to a point in that Franklin Roosevelt was very concerned about what was happening in Britain during the Blitz, and with Winston Churchill, who was all but begging for the United States to help because they were standing alone at the time. And President Roosevelt gives a speech about that's in the program about we will be the arsenal of democracy. And that was really the best he could do at the time, because there were so many people that said that's Europe's problem. It's not our problem. It's funny how echoes of that, you know, have been handed down through our generations, even to today. It's like, where do we draw the line about where to get involved and where not to get involved? And we think that we're facing, sometimes, you know, we lose perspective, I believe, and we think we're facing these issues for the first time. And to see some of these isolationist speeches that were happening in the months before the attack on Pearl Harbor, you realize that we aren't the first ones to have to take on these issues and make decisions about them.
I just find it all fascinating, Tom, and I'm anxious for our people to watch this program and strongly encourage people to watch this. If you don't have a clear understanding of what went on December 7th, 1941, I think you will this time, because there are pictures in here of damage in downtown Honolulu, in addition to the battleships on Battleship Row and everything else. It's just fascinating.
We went literally to the ends of the earth looking for images, looking for photography that hasn't been published since 1941. Obviously, the news broadcast. There's very few newsreels in there, because newsreels, in a sense, make you feel like you're watching some kind of clip show or something like that.
Right.
we're trying to make, we tried to incorporate everything we could get our hands on to make it feel like you're watching a movie about Pearl Harbor, but it's not with Ben Affleck. It's a movie using the
real people.
It's the real stuff.
Real people.
But put it, put in storytelling form.
The gentleman we were talking to before I brought you on, out at the Michigan Heritage Museum, there's a story that he has in there of one of the pilots that was, he had just gotten over there, and he was one of the few pilots to get in the air, and unfortunately was killed. So his World War II experience was about 8 minutes. And that his family, and I think it was in the Free Press this morning, and they're talking about his family has his car. Because he was an officer, he was able to bring his car to Hawaii when he went over there. And they still have the car, and now they take it around to all these veterans events and so forth. And it has a bullet hole in the trunk, and it had one in the windshield that they replaced. Mm-hmm. But it's just, you know, it's one of these stories just like yours, Tom. And I want to congratulate you. I can't imagine anybody seeing this documentary and not coming away with a whole new perspective and viewpoint on how World War II started and what happened. And I hope it encourages them to go back and talk to any of their great-grandparents or grandparents that are alive and say, what were you doing? What was it like?
Exactly. That's what we're hoping to do with it, too. I mean, I'd like to say that there's never been a Pearl Harbor documentary like this one, but I know there's been so many. We looked at as many as we could, and we never found one that used this style with Pearl Harbor, at least not in the last 20 years. And so, yes, you're correct that that's what we want to do. You know, in Pearl Harbor, in a sense, a lot of what went on 40, 50, 60, 70 years ago, especially concerning the military, they become these iconic events, and people just get these images in their heads about, Pearl Harbor, you know, the planes and Battleship Row, and I think it loses its importance in a way because these were real people. They're not just photographs that happened, you know, and by hearing the voices and hearing the panic and trying to understand what went on by actually, in a sense, walking beside them, you know, through media, it takes on a completely different complexion. I know my editor producer, his name is David Tillman. He was tasked with going through hundreds of the hours of this material. And he's a younger guy, but he's taken on a completely different appreciation for what went on during that time because it goes well beyond any history lesson that you're going to get in school.
Oh, absolutely. I can't, you know, I think every high school in America should be showing this to their kids and give them a whole new idea. But we've been talking with Tom Jennings, and Tom, I want to thank you very much. Please keep me on your email list and let me know what's going on next. I think it's going to be, I'm anxious to see all of your series of the lost tapes.
Thank you, Dale. It's a pleasure. And thanks for doing what you do. I think it's terrific.
Thank you. We'll be talking to you again soon.
Okay. Be well.
Thanks, Tom. All right. That's tonight. The Lost Tapes, Pearl Harbor, Smithsonian Channel, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. If you have, and this is in the local area, so check your local listings for the Smithsonian. You can just go to smithsonian.org, and it'll ask you to plug in your zip code, and it'll tell you what station it is on. But locally, it's on Comcast. It's on channel 388. DirecTV is channel 570. Dish Network is 367. AT&T is 118. Do it. Next week, we are going to be doing Gifts for Veterans. And so any of you out there that have any gifts or ideas or own a company that provides merchandise for veterans or you think would be appropriate for veterans, please let us know. We'll put you on the program. Go to veteransradio.net, click on Contact Us, and we will get in touch with you. We'll get you on the program next week. And until then, you are dismissed.